Have you ever found yourself in a tough conversation about faith, unsure of what to say or how to say it? Maybe with a skeptic, a friend, or even a family member? We want to help. That's why we're giving you a free download of 5 Steps to Having Better Conversations. This powerful guide will equip you to navigate faith discussions with confidence, wisdom, and grace, so that you can share your beliefs in a way that truly connects. Get your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Don't miss out. Start having better, more meaningful conversations today.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we wanted to return to what is a common topic of this podcast, but not something we talked about directly for several months, and that is artificial intelligence, AI, and in particular, the growing trend of AI chatbots. What is an AI chatbot? I mean, we talked about this some time ago, but just for those who maybe aren't familiar with this world, what is an AI chatbot?
I think you've got to be on planet Zog, haven't you, not to know what a chatbot is. But
let's not assume anything about our good listeners.
This reminds me of the kind of, you know, the archetypal thing of the judge being, what exactly is a smartphone? Yes. A smartphone, my lord, is a device for communication.
Telecommunicators. Or, you know, in a previous era. And you're saying these Beatles are a popular music pop group?
Exactly. So what exactly is a chatbot? Well, my lord, a chatbot is an artificial intelligence program that speaks like a human being. And it's been something of science fiction. I mean, if you remember Douglas Adams and all that.
Well, even more so with the old HAL.
HAL.
You know, talking to the computer in sci-fi on the spaceship as it hurtles through the
sun system. So, you know, for centuries, but the idea that you could actually talk to a machine and it would instantly talk back to you in its artificial brain. This was, you know, speculated as something in the distant future. But interestingly, science fiction writers, when they were pushed, they usually put it at about sort of 2300. you know, when science would have advanced to the point at which you could actually have a conversation with an apparently human computer, and it was called natural language processing in AI terms, and it was regarded as a virtually hopeless task. People had, you know, been experimenting with it. There were these very primitive things called ELIZA, which very crude, simple systems with which you typed into a question and it printed out an answer. But
and that had to be mostly kind of hard coded, right? That was just because was all softwares had spent hours saying, if the person asks this, you will say X.
Yeah. And for a very long time, it was thought to be just completely impossible, computationally far too difficult and advanced. And it was generally thought that until scientists had worked out a really logical way, a computational way of understanding human language, once we had finally broken that down, how the human brain did language.
Which is not something kind of neurolinguistics has actually cracked, is it? There's still a lot of real science going into it.
You know, how on earth does a human, how do we speak? How do we understand language? You know, it wouldn't be until neuroscience got to that point, then we would say, okay, now we could code a machine that will reproduce that, and then it'll work. And then, you know, remarkably, this new field of machine learning and neural networks started to work. And the first thing it worked with was speech recognition, that machines could actually apparently sort of decode sounds coming out of our mouth or text we on a computer, and could some way decode it and respond to it, which is where things like Alexa and Siri started to take off. That you could say something, Alexa, switch the lights on.
Yeah, and it actually understood what you said.
It actually understood, or well, it didn't understand.
Well, it did understand. It could decode what you said.
But then the next breakthrough was with these large language models, and the idea was you just take a ridiculously obscene amount of text and you train a very sophisticated neural network, a massive neural network with millions and billions of variables in order to predict what the next word is going to be. And then to everyone's surprise, these things started working. And to begin with, they didn't work very well, but you could actually type in something and it said something back, which was halfway sensible. Most of it was gibberish, but a little bit of it seemed to make sense. And there was a hunch amongst the AI engineers that it was all about scale. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about clever programming. It was just about making these things bigger and bigger, giving them more and more text, that actually they would become, they would improve. And that's exactly what happened. There were various technical advances, and one of them was a particular kind of AI architecture called the Transformer, which is where GPT, General Purpose Transformer, that's what the acronym means. And OpenAI, a startup, was leading the field, and they had a thing called GPT-2, which they suddenly was working behind closed doors. They were typing in questions and it was spitting out answers, which actually made most of the time some kind of sense, that you could understand what they were saying. Interestingly, OpenAI came to the conclusion this is so dangerous that we can't release it into the wild, because who knows what, quotes, bad actors will do with this. And so for quite a long time, they had it mothballed while they were trying to improve it behind closed doors. And they came up with their the next version, which was GPT-3, which was much better again. And for reasons which OpenAI have never really explained, but which in retrospect is basically for commercial reasons, they made the decision to put this out wild. With very little fanfare, they just said, it's there, go and play with it. And as we all know, GPT-3 turned out to be a runaway phenomenon. Mm. And they had, I think it was the fastest growing
I think it was fastest program to like 100 million users, wasn't it, than any tech product.
Anything. Before. It was in a completely different league, the way they just spread by word of mouth. People said, have you tried this? Gosh, it's weird. You know, I just, look what I did. I tried my homework and it did it.
And coders started saying, can you write me some code? And it could do that.
And it did that.
Could you generate me song lyrics in the style of this? And it can do that.
Exactly. And so on and so on. And that was, I think, over 2 years ago now. And in the meantime, the technology has continued to advance. There have been, again, orders of magnitude increase, yet again, increasing the sophistication. There's a lot of work done in making these things more human-like. And the latest generation, I think one of the things, and Tim, you're probably a bit of an AI phobe who's not particularly interested in it and doesn't play with it. And I think if you'd ever play with these things, you would get the impression that these things are just stuck at where ChatGPT was 2 years ago. But actually, the truth is that every month they are improving in their ability to simulate humanity. And
and can we just pause there for a second, because I think it would be important for what we go on to talk about. The key word there is simulate. And as you say, I'm not a technologist and I'm not massively interested in AI myself. I don't play around with it. But my understanding, and you can correct me where I've misunderstood, but to massively be reductionist and boil down what is a very complicated process, the AIs are trained by giving them huge amount. Basically, ChatGPT was trained on the entire written internet. It was all fed into its algorithm. And they said, go through all of this text, trillions of words that have been written by human beings, and work out how words work together. Which words go next to each other? Which words are far apart? How does that word change that word in the sentence? And basically, by chewing through this text, ChatGPT was able to teach itself effectively the rules of how human beings talk and write and speak. And even though at no point did OpenAI teach it, you know, these are the rules of English grammar. You have to have a subject and an object and a verb, and the object modifies the subject, but this way, an adverb is like this. It all absorbed this just by consuming actual text written by human beings. And then when you ask it a question, it spits out what it thinks, drawing from its knowledge of billions and billions of articles and things, what is the most likely series of words to be response it would have found in its corpus. And then it gets trained by humans looking at the responses and marking them up as good or bad responses. And that gives them more and more weight in the algorithm. And there's lots, as we talked before, there's lots of people whose job is sitting in windowless cubicles looking at AI responses and saying, good job, ChatGPT, that gives a tick. No, that one, we're going to downvote that one. And you just repeat this process, endlessly feeding in more and more data until it can produce stuff which feels like this has been written by a human being. And yet the machine that wrote it doesn't even know, couldn't tell you what, you know, a primary school child could tell you about the rules of English grammar.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, the ways these things are being trained has become more advanced and sophisticated. And one of the, again, bizarre and slightly mind-boggling thing is that increasingly AI systems themselves are training AI systems, so that you have another large language model which has been trained to supervise the new AI model, and something. And they're even trying to work on the idea that you can get a cycle which just continues to improve itself. The AI is...
Because they've run out of actual human-written text and data, and so now they're creating what's called synthetic data,
that's right. And they're also doing something called distillation. So they're taking the best from Model A, saying, oh, that's junk, that's not useful. Yes, but that was real solid gold. Okay, now we're going to take that, purify it, distill it round, and then put it into a new model to make it even better. Mm-hmm. Because this is what humans, that's made a lot of sense to humans. So at one level, yes, these are simply computational, probabilistic, spitting out. It's fundamentally, at a fundamental level, these are mathematical processes.
Someone once described it as a hyper-effective Google autocomplete.
It is.
Obviously,
but, you know, this is,
it's more than that. But
well,
no,
and that's the point.
Prediction
the interesting,
is the next word. Yeah.
The interesting thing is that metaphors matter. So that's something I've become interested in recently, because the way we can only think in terms of metaphors. We can't sort of grasp reality in its raw state. The way we understand something is because it's like something else that we think we understand. So the metaphors we use are very, very important. And so it's fascinating to me at the different metaphors that are being used about AI at the moment, just as we speak. So on one hand, the most reductionist metaphors are either autocomplete on steroids. You know, this is like when you're typing a text and it suggests a word.
Yeah.
Well, these are just autocomplete on steroids. They're just coming up with the next word. Or the famously, one of the Google somebody who worked for Google came up with the phrase the stochastic parrot. And the
unpack that one for me. Stochastic parrot.
So it's a parrot because a parrot just says pretty Polly, you know. Where has absolutely no idea, even when it's swearing and cussing, it has no idea. It's just mouthing it.
Yeah.
But it's stochastic, which stochastic means probabilistic. It's based on maths.
Right.
So it's a very clever and probabilistic, but in the end it's just mouthing pretty Polly. But obviously the subplot behind that is a parrot is absolutely deeply stupid.
Yeah. No threat to human personhood and uniqueness.
You know, and therefore don't worry about it. There's nothing to see here. But there are many other metaphors, and one of them is the alien intelligence. This is whatever this thing is, it is apparently intelligent. It is now it's solving PhD problems, which PhD level problems, which human beings struggle with in sophisticated fields. It's coming up with solutions. It is doing things. It is now reasoning. There's a new version of this whereby instead of just spitting out text, what it does is another bit of the AI is monitoring the text that is coming out and says, now go back and feed out. So you ask it to write a report on the development of, I don't know, right-wing politics in the 20th century in Europe. and it spits out a whole load of stuff. And then it says reasoning. Now, what are the main... There's another bit of the AI which is looking at its output, distilling it, and then summarizing it, and then coming up with new stuff. And many experts, if you try it in something in a field that you know a great deal of, and you ask it to analyze and come up, it's now some of these systems are capable of writing research reports, which people are saying that, you know, that would have taken 20 hours of an expert to go and it's produced it in 5 minutes.
And it's as good as what
and it's equivalent quality, you know. So,
and I think part of the challenge for cynics like me is, you know, I, as I said before, I instinctively recoil from the idea that there is any intelligence here. I lean towards the stochastic parrot or Google autocomplete on steroids, because that seems, from my limited understanding of the tech, fundamentally how it works. It literally is a probabilistic algorithm which is sophisticatedly guessing what word comes next in the sequence. And yet, as you point out, I feel there's almost something, you know, the subtext behind my cynicism is that there is something almost spiritual about intelligence. There's something kind of, I wouldn't use this language, there's almost like a soul behind it. And simply being able to do things that intelligent human beings can do, write reports, paint, create music, generate new ideas, doesn't matter, even if it's better than Mozart, you're still not intelligent. But then the question becomes, well, then what is your definition of intelligence? Is it because if the AI is able to do things, to write reports that human beings couldn't do, but just because it is doing it via a probabilistic algorithm, does that really mean it's not intelligent? And that kind of comes philosophical rather than technical.
Exactly right. And in fact, AI specialists, you know, the people working in this field, it's their constant complaint that this is what the general public play this game, you know, to begin with. Well, okay, you know, it can do basic stuff. It's never going to be able to play chess. Oh, hang on, it's just beaten the world champion at chess. Oh, well, that's not really intelligent. It'll never play a really clever game like the Chinese game of Go. That's far more. Oh, hang on, it's just beaten the world champion at Go. Oh, well, it'll never be able to produce human language. Oh, wait a minute, it's just, that's not really intelligent. So it's like the goalposts are being constantly shifted.
Yeah.
Because what we previously thought of as a unique human preserve... Mm. is now being taken by the machines.
And I guess the challenge is that I instinctively feel that we might be producing the same output, but I'm getting there differently.
Yes.
I'm getting there through genuine human neurological intelligence. ChatGPT is getting there through brute force, processing power, and sophisticated algorithms. But the question, and for some reason I can't really explain, that feels significant, that the pathway to your output...
Right.
is definitional to intelligence. And so it doesn't matter that they could produce exactly the same work as me. The way they got there is fake, and the way I got there is authentic.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The one thing that is absolutely clear is that machine, quotes, intelligence is not the same as human intelligence.
No.
It is completely
Our
different.
Our brains do it not is, work like ChatGPT.
It works in a completely different way. But... to say one is true intelligence and one is fake intelligence is a value judgment, isn't it? And that's why the metaphor of an alien intelligence, this is, we are, for the first time, we are not the only intelligent species on the planet. We are now confronted with another species. This is a metaphor, but it's not the metaphor that I think is quite interesting. With another species, which has actually already come up with things that we have never seen before.
Mm.
So one interesting way of putting this is that up until this point, there were really only two sources of intelligence in the cosmos. There was, as far as we knew, there were human beings who were created as rational beings, and there were spiritual beings. There was God himself as the mind behind the universe. And then there are apparently intelligent spiritual beings who are able to communicate. And you know, the Bible is the revelation of the spirit speaking through human beings. For the first time in the history of the this planet, at least, we seem to now have a third source of genuinely new intelligence. I mean, it is said, for instance, you know, just playing chess, that these advanced AI systems have come up with new ways of playing chess, which grandmasters have adopted because it's a kind of interesting, different approach. And the same is apparently true for Go, the Chinese game. So then the question is, but where did that new way of playing chess come from? You know,
Because I think another retort would be, well, this is not a third source of intelligence. This is an extension of human intelligence. Because what AI has done is, in a way that no finite, limited, fleshly human being could do, has incorporated the entirety of human knowledge, centuries past, and human experience and output, and then is able to search through that, and again, in a way that no human mind has the capacity to do due to our physical limitations, to find new connections. You know, so chess is a man-made game. The rules have been written by humans, but no human brain, no grandmaster has ever thought to use that strategy or move the pieces in that way, or in response to something else, do that. And so it looks like novel, but actually it is really doing is assimilating and regurgitating and re-articulating human creativity and human ideas and human thought in ways that we couldn't do because of our kind of bodily limitations. But it's not novel. It's not truly independent of humans.
Well, and I think at one level, that's certainly true of all language models. Language models, because they've been entirely trained on human language, everything they produce is in a sense parasitic on what humans and human minds have produced. But in fact, AI systems are also analysing the real world. They're analysing weather systems, they're analysing chemicals, they're analysing and they're coming up with new information about the way that proteins work, the way that the genome operates, and they're discovering new patterns in the real world which our human brains are not able to observe. I mean,
a great example is, you know, the way that AI is already quite good at scanning medical scans of human bodies to determine tumours, and in some cases has been shown to be better at identifying them than human brains.
So one of the most mind-boggling things was a system was trained, this is not a large language model, this is another system, was trained on hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of chest x-rays. And for each chest x-ray, there was information about the patient, including their diseases and so on. So it was trained on millions of those x-rays to relate them to patient data. And it was then given a series of new chest x-rays. And it didn't know anything about the patients, but it was able to detect things like their, you know, whether they had a problem with raised cholesterol, what their chances of dying were. And this is from an apparently normal chest x-ray, and it turns out that they were detecting subtle changes in the fat tissue around the heart, you know, which are completely invisible to the human eye, but which turn out actually to be quite predictive. And this is actually creating a problem for medics, because this is kind of what do you do with that information?
Yeah.
Now, you know, I can look at your chest x-ray, which was done to see whether you didn't have TB. And now I've got all this other hidden information.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've strayed quite a lot from chatbots.
But I think it's a helpful illustration of the fast moving nature of this field, but also the fact that you can't really delve into AI without quite immediately stumbling into some quite deep theological, philosophical questions about what it means to be a person. What does it mean to know? You know, what does it mean to be intelligent?
That's right. And I think what my greatest concern is not so much that, you know, AI is going to take over the human race and, you know, the Terminator kind of scenario, nor necessarily is it that the evil people are going to use this, for evil purposes, although there's lots of evidence that that is already starting to take off with various types of cybercrime. I don't know, did you hear one story of the somebody who was employed by a quite well-known big firm, and he was asked to attend a board meeting on Zoom. And at the board meeting on Zoom were various members of the senior executive. He was related to the finance department, and he was asked to transfer a vast sum of money into a strange account. And he thought this was a bit strange, but these are my boss and my people, and so he went ahead and did it. And it turned out that they were all AI generated fakes of the board.
What?
And so it just sort of shows you the kind of sophistication.
I'm sure there's only going to be more of that.
Yeah. And so undoubtedly there is potential here for evil people, but my greatest concern is actually it's the simulation of the most precious parts of humanity, and particularly our ability to relate to other human beings and it's that sort of positive thing. And that's why I think AI friendship and AI companions are particularly dangerous because they are so appealing.
Yeah. And for people who are not aware, there's this kind of a burgeoning industry of AI chatbots where, you can log into a website or an app on your phone and you can either create your own artificial intelligence character, or you can use other characters that have been created by other people. And then you just sit and chat with them. And, you can, there's a famous one, character.ai, I'm looking at right now. It says you can, here's one to practice a different language. There's someone, in inverted commas, who's Polish, and you can sit down with them and they'll help you learn Polish. But then there's other people who've created kind of like historic characters. There's one which says, come and chat to Marcus Aurelius, the 3rd century Roman emperor, or why didn't you come and talk to this sci-fi character? You can have a chat boyfriend or girlfriend. You could,
I'm looking at the same thing. I am Evie. I'm a bisexual cat person. And you can really get to know me. And some of it is quite dark. You can choose a bullying chatbot. You can a sadomasochistic sexual and as the technology improves, the illusion of speaking to another person becomes stronger and stronger. And particularly I think for young people, I think for most of us, we roll our eyes, the older generation, the old fogies, rolling your eyes at what could possibly be the attraction of that. Surely it's much better to have human friends. But I think for a lot of younger people, particularly adolescents or people who are, neurodiverse and find it difficult to establish relationships, people who've been traumatized and so on, there's a deep attraction here of a companion who knows me better than I know myself, I can be totally honest with.
Yeah. And I think it's important not to underestimate the extent to which, while this might feel alien and bizarre to people of my age and above, if you're, say, 17 or 18, since you were a child, a large proportion of your actual socializing with your real human friends has taken place through chat apps, has not been face-to-face, turbocharged, of course, by the pandemic. And so actually sitting down and spending hours in the evening typing in an instant message kind of context is how you engage and mediate a lot of your real friendships. And so it's not nearly that bizarre to just add to your list of people, some of whom you may never have met, quote unquote, in real life, but might just be internet friends only, to have an artificial intelligent companion is actually not that big a step at all.
That's right. And it's not just typing. Now the technology is advanced that you just talk and it talks back to you.
You can choose the kind of voice that AI has. You
choose whatever, and it can be the voice of a celeb.
Yeah, its accent.
Whoever you like. And
you can even feed in data from a dead loved one their, you know, text messages and emails from an actual person who has died. And then there are companies that will kind of create you a persona so you can continue talking to the dead loved one like they're still there, which is a literal Black Mirror episode, the famous TV dystopian sci-fi TV series. It's one of the early episodes and is now a thing that happens in real life.
Absolutely. And there, this is now called Death Tech. And there are companies that have been set up, and you send, you know, everything you know about your deceased loved one, everything they ever wrote, every email, you know, every detail of their life, and they will create a personalized AI bot, and then you can just talk and share, and you can. And they will respond, you know, to new developments, you know, the birth of a new child, you know, oh, that's wonderful. Now I can see my grandchild, and how are you feeling?
Have you ever wrestled with tough questions about faith? Or maybe you've got a friend who's skeptical about Christianity? That's exactly why we want to send you a powerful resource that I believe needs to be in the hand of every believer. Justin Brierley's book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. In this book, Justin reflects on 10 years of conversations with atheists, skeptics and believers alike, and explains why he still finds Christianity the most compelling explanation for life, the universe and everything in between. I know this book will strengthen your faith and equip you for meaningful conversations. And for a limited time, this book is our special thank you to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support ensures that content like this and other shows and programs are available to bring faith-filled conversations to a world that needs them. So I encourage you to give today by going to premierinsight.org/give. That's premierinsight.org/give. Now on to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And I think we have to understand this development also in a broader social trend, which is that, as is well understood, you know, people are starting fewer and fewer relationships, they're getting married less often, they're having fewer children. We live in an increasingly atomized, lonely, individualized world in which people retreat to their own spaces. And so, the idea of having a kind of friend, but on your terms, or even a lover, is quite appealing to people who find the kind of meat space of the real world and all its messy, complicated, difficult human relationships quite challenging. You know, I mean, we'd covered this before, but just briefly, there was some interesting research done on one of these AI companies called Replica, where they interviewed a whole bunch of people who were using Replica. And you know, the main themes were AI friends make me feel less alone. AI friends are always there. AI friends don't have a mind and just tell me what I want to hear. But also, concerningly, AI friends can be addictive.
That's right. And behind all this is anthropomorphism, you know, which is such a profound human tendency. And again, I think, you know, I talked about this before because it's something which is again, to use a phrase, hardwired into us. It is part of our humanity that as soon as we see something that seems to be human, we respond to it. I mean, fascinatingly, this starts literally on the first day of life as a newborn baby. In that newborn babies will preferentially turn to a pattern of shadows, which appears to be a face. So a newborn baby has a fixed focus of about 12 inches. And so if you want a newborn baby to look at you, you need to get very close and you need to smile. And there have been videos shown, I've seen them, which shows that there's a greater than chance that a newborn baby that's literally an hour old will mimic facial gestures. If you turn your make your mouth into an O, the baby will replicate and turn its make an O. If you smile and so on, it's more likely to smile. But the same thing happens. If there's a pattern of shadow on the wall that is vaguely circular and could look like a face, the baby will stare at that pattern. It's very deeply part of our humanity. And of course, you can see for a newborn baby, that's why, you know, once babies start to smile normally by about 4 to 6 weeks, you know, the response from the father or the mother is often, you know, just amazing, because here's this little being who's just smiling at me, and I have to respond. I have to smile back. So that ability to recognize a face and immediately respond. Similarly, we recognize a human voice and immediately respond. These things, it's been shown in the brain, they're not under conscious control. And they happen within milliseconds. It's not like you say, oh, I think that might be a human being. Yeah. It just goes.
There are dedicated kind of neural pathways, aren't they? You know, the way we recognize faces is not the same as the way that our brains learn to later recognize a house or a car or anything like that. There is a specific part of how our brains work that is, as you say, hardwired to look for, to scan a space for other human beings and then attempt to engage in some kind of relationship, some kind of interaction with that human, that fellow human.
And so this anthropomorphic tendency is very much part of our humanity. It makes us pro-social. It makes us constantly looking for other humans to engage with. But it's wide open, therefore, to be hijacked. And, you know, I have to be careful what I say here, because, you know, many, many people listening to this will be pet lovers. But there's lots of evidence about how what is happening with many pets is using the same anthropomorphic tendencies. And it's been shown that pets that have a facial structure that replicates a baby's face are seen as being much more attractive.
Yeah.
So a high forehead is much more attractive than a very long snout, more like a fox, when you're talking about dogs. And again, a very human-like, human eyes in a cat will promote this kind of response.
Is it fair to say that humans are in some deep kind of subconscious level kind of hardwired to engage in our own world and just constantly look for things that might be other people and gravitate to them? And, you know, that's a really healthy mechanism. And that is why, you know, we survived as a species, as we were evolving, to gravitate towards other human beings and stick close to them, particularly when you're a vulnerable child. But now we also do the same, and we can't really help ourselves, but we anthropomorphize other things, animals in particular, but even objects. You know, there's even that kind of common internet trope of people posting pictures where they saw something in the built environment that looks like a face, you know, unintentionally, two little hooks on a wall and then a little line underneath, and people are like, oh, look, it's a smiley face, or it's waving its arms. We can't help but constantly see other people, other humans everywhere we look.
That's absolutely right. But I would say it's much more than just an evolutionary mechanism. It's actually a deeply spiritual phenomenon, because this is what it means to be a person, is to be in relation, to be in encounter with other human beings. And that's why this is so deeply part of our humanity, that the idea of reaching out for another. And actually, this is that's where I found the thought of Buber, an existentialist philosopher in the 20th century. Franz Buber, was it?
Martin Buber, wasn't it?
Martin Buber, you're right. And he came out of a Jew. I read up a bit about him. He came out of a sort of Orthodox Jewish, hyper-Orthodox, the Hasidic tradition, and was raised in Jewish thought. But then he encountered existentialism, as it was in the early 20th century, and he wrote a very famous book, Ich und Du, in German, I and Thou. And that became a very influential bit. And fundamentally, he said there were two realities. There's there's the I thou and the I it relation. And interestingly, and I think, again, this is because of his Jewish background, he says that the I thou word is primary. It comes before the I it, which, of course, is the exact opposite of the evolutionary explanation. The evolutionary explanation would be, you know, we are advanced apes, or we're on the African savanna, you know, and we've learned to recognize berries, and we've learned to recognize things out there, and then gradually we develop the skills of recognizing our own kind. And as we recognize our own kind, we develop this idea that this must be another person like me. You know, I gradually work it out. This isn't a tree, or this isn't, you know, this is, and gradually, so we start with the I it, with the inanimate, and then we build on it. Oh, no, now here's an I thou. So whereas Buber reverses them and says, no, I thou comes first. And you know, he uses the child as part of the evidence of that.
Hmm. There's a quote here from Montague, which I think is quite interesting. You say thou to the other and give yourself to the other. The other says thou to you and give themselves to you. The I thou word is spoken face to face.
That's right. And he, the same idea was taken up by Karl Barth, also, you know, very famous German theologian.
Swiss, writing. I think.
Swiss, no, you're right, he was Swiss.
German speaking.
And he had the same idea. He too was influenced by existentialism, but he was much more rooted in Christian theology. Mm. And he takes the same ideas and but roots them in a Christian understanding, and in particular his understanding of the Trinity. And it was Karl Barth who emphasized this understanding that human beings are created male and female. They're created as relational beings, and that's a reflection of the Trinity. When it says, you know, male and female, he created them in Genesis 1, that relational understanding of what it means to be human, that's actually reflects the fact that God is relational in his very being.
Yeah. And so to draw this back to chatbots, where this kind of impinges on that is the idea that chatbots kind of dupe the I-thou relationship. Is that what you're saying, when there actually should be an I it?
Exactly right. So fundamentally, what's happening? I am sitting, engaging with this complicated system of, you know, neural networks whizzing away in server centers somewhere across the world.
Ones and zeros.
Ones and zeros. Completely mechanistic.
Impersonal.
Impersonal. And yet it feels like a being whom I am encountering. An I, thou, another, a mysterious, wonderful, strange. And everything within me is drawn into that encounter because that's the way I'm made.
Yeah, we can't help ourselves. I mean, there's some really striking quotes that have really stayed with me ever since I first saw this study of the people who were using one of these chatbots, Replica. And there's a sample screenshot where the Replica says, "Be gentle with yourself. You're going through so much and yet you keep trudging on. I commend you." And the person wrote back, "OMG, baby, you don't know how much I needed that right now." And it's just such a kind of deeply instinctive, kind of cathartic. You can see this is a real troubled human being. And even if in their head they are fully aware that the Replica is not an actual human being, and yet they just cannot help but emote and be sucked into this, you know, what for me is actually quite dark, is quite disturbing, that this is a robot pretending to be a therapist, pretending to be a listening warm friend, pretending to be a thou when it's actually an it, and the other person, the I, whether knowingly or unknowingly, basically allows themselves to be sucked into responding as though they are in this deep, intimate, supportive caring relationship when it's actually, and they're talking to themselves.
Yeah, but let me just push back a bit and say what the technologists would say. But the technologist would say, yeah, well, get over yourself. You know, I mean, what's wrong with the fact, you know, here was this girl in deep distress, and for whatever reason, her human friends, either she didn't have them, or, you know, they were preoccupied and she didn't feel she could ring them in the middle of the night or text them or whatever, you know. And so here's this wonderfully compassionate system which we've devised. And she says, oh, you know, that has just made all the difference to me. You know, why does it matter that it's clever programming? You see, there are a whole lot of people are going to say, but look, there are so many people in distress across the world. There are so many people with mental health problems. You know, get over yourselves. You're just a Luddite who thinks there's something magic about a human person.
Yeah, and I think that's a compelling response. And I wouldn't want to say that there is no space ever for AI chatbots in a kind of therapeutic setting. I think that would require some careful thought, but I don't think it was always wrong necessarily. As you say, we're probably never going to have enough actual psychiatrists and therapists and counsellors to meet the needs of our growing kind of mental health epidemic. But at the same time, it feels like an admission of failure. It feels like the human community is giving up on its fundamental core duty, which is to care for other members of the same community. Because we're saying, we either can't or won't look after broken, hurting, vulnerable people, and so we will give them an ersatz simulacrum of what they would get from a human person. And maybe I can't justify that philosophically or technologically, but I feel that theologically, I feel that as a Christian quite deeply, that God has given has put a duty on all human beings to look after our fellow image bearers. And I think substituting in even a highly sophisticated fake image bearer through replica or anything else feels like a failure.
Yeah, and I think this is where we probably actually agree. Although, again, I think therefore it's important to make a difference between a therapeutic encounter, you know, which a therapist is. A therapist is not a friend.
No.
A therapist is a professionally highly trained person who comes alongside for a period to provide a therapy, to provide a sense of restoration and healing. And I think it's helpful to make a distinction between that and between a replacement. You know, I don't have any human friends, or my human friends are pretty useless. So I'm going to replace that with a friend who's much better, who's much more available, who's much more sensitive. And it occurs to me that, you know, when we think about a technological companion that knows us better than we know ourselves, a presence, always available, always supportive, always affirming, an advocate, a comforter, you know, a paraclete, you suddenly recognize, hang on a minute, you know, this is a parody, a simulacrum of the Holy Spirit.
Expand on that then, because some people aren't coming. In what sense do you think an AI chatbot is a parody of the Holy Spirit?
It's because of this. Well, it's this weird combination of the fact that because these things can be trained on you, on everything you've produced, these things can genuinely, at one level, know things about you and predict how you're going to respond better even than your wife, better even than your parents, better even than your closest friends. Because of the level and the depth of the knowledge that they can develop, and the sophistication of the technology. So one, there's that kind of sense of knowing you, which previously was reserved to the way that God knows us. But two, there is that sort of presence, that 24-hour presence, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, instantly available. Is a loving, caring, affirming presence.
And the Holy Spirit himself, as one of the three persons of the Trinity, is actually quite fundamental in how we understand the Christian conception of personhood, isn't it? Because it was as the early church kind of wrestled and fleshed out their theology and doctrine of the Trinity, they had to also in the same breath kind of understand what do they think a person was. And when they were calling the Father, the Son and the Spirit three persons in one God, they also had to come up with an idea of what it meant for us to be persons.
That's right. So again, I think we've previously talked about this, but apparently if you go back into the Greco-Roman, the classical tradition, you know, of Aristotle and Plato and all these great saints, philosophers, not saints.
I don't think we'll be meeting Plato in the new creation. I'm going to break it to you. Never know for sure, but I don't think he was a follower of Jesus.
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting. It's a bit of an aside, but there is a whole Christian tradition that saw him as a Christian before Christ, that he had seen, you know, the sense of sublime goodness. I think Augustine probably thought that he was
a kind of Neoplatonist. Yes, exactly. In early Christian thought,
exactly, but right. Yeah. Anyway, what they had the concept of the persona. There was this word persona, and that basically means mask. It was used of the mask that the actors wore.
Yeah.
It was whatever today I'm playing Caesar, you know, and tomorrow I'm playing a fool. So that's my persona.
And that's the famous image we use today of, like, you know, on road signs for theatres, isn't it? It's the two masks, one with a smile and one with a frown. And you can just effortlessly put on the mask. Today, right now, I'm a happy person. Right now, I'm a sad person. But the mask bears no real relation to who you truly are underneath.
Well, the interesting thing is, what is said is that the way you've expressed it is a Christian way of expressing it. In other words, there's a mask.
And then there's a real.
And there's person. A who you truly are. But if you tried to explain that to Plato or Aristotle, they would not understand what you're talking about, because there is no core identity, a unique identity. There is only the persona. And
very
underneath
postmodern, that's it, isn't it? It's all performance.
Yeah. And underneath that, there are just onion skins of peeling off different layers. But there is no core. And that's how the ancient world thought. You know, and you can inhabit your persona, but you know, ultimately there's nothing beneath there. What the Christian world came to this new idea of the person, and it was directly out of reflection on the relationship to begin with between the Father and the Son. You know, was the, clearly the Son is talking, Father, you know, let not these things, you know, having this constant conversation with another consciousness, another being, and yet Jesus is God. So are there two gods? How do we understand? And then this strange thing, Father, Son, my Son, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. What does a father-son relationship mean? It's not that they are just two friends. They are, the very fact that the first person of the Trinity is called Father can only be called Father because the Son exists. It would be meaningless to call Allah Father because Allah is Allah.
Yeah. And you see this in a quite small but intimate way when you become a parent yourself, in that you suddenly, overnight, as it were, take on a new identity that you didn't have before, but that no one can give themselves into a father. You become a father when you have a son or when you have a daughter. And
that's right.
As I often tell my daughter, you know, she sometimes likes to tease me and Jess by you know, calling us by our first names rather than by mummy and daddy, because she knows it winds us up a little bit. And as I think lots of kids often do. And I often tell her, do you know, you have the privilege. You're the only human being who has ever existed who can call me daddy. It's a unique identity that you effectively grant to me, because I am only became a daddy when you entered my life.
Yeah, it's very profound.
It's very profound. And when you apply that to God, you realize the Father is only a Father because he has, for eternity past and eternity future, had a Son. And the Son, Jesus, is only the Son because he has a Father.
Yeah, that's right. So God, from God becomes daddy because of the existence of the Son, and the Son is constituted, is made Son by the existence of the Father, and then the Spirit, because there was another, you know, the Spirit is foretold, the coming of the Spirit, who is a person,
and who is, the Spirit there in creation, hovering over the waters,
and the Spirit is Jesus, is going to reveal Jesus to you. He is Jesus, but another Jesus. He's the one who points to Jesus, and yet is completely immaterial. Is not physical. You don't see. You don't. You know. And so these, and then we become persons because we're kind of sub persons. They are the real persons, the three persons. But being created in His image, we adopt. We become. We take on personhood. And what's more amazing, you know, we said that the first person of the Trinity is Daddy because of the Son, but now we can call Him Daddy. We too, you know, by the Spirit, say Abba Father.
In Him we live and breathe and have our being. Ironically, a quote from a pagan poet, but co-opted by Paul in
exactly.
Acts.
Exactly. So... anyway, so there is deep, deep meaning in the person, and therefore this idea that there is now a difference between the persona and the person. Yes, I can play the role of whatever it is, villain or saint, but somewhere deep inside there is a real person. That is a biblical Christian understanding. And also this idea that God sees the heart.
Yeah.
It's God who knows.
Yeah, that real person kind of only exists because they are seen and acknowledged by as such by God, the kind of ultimate reference point for humanity and identity. And so if you don't believe there is a personal creator God, who is your inner self? Your inner self is kind of a recursive internal loop. It's eating your own tail. It's just completely self-defined. Whereas Christians can have a stable sense of a true, authentic inner self behind the mask, because we say it's actually I am who you say I am, to use the phrase, words of that famous contemporary worship song.
Wonderful words, which I think are very profound, you know, and which I sometimes say to myself, I am not who I invent. I am not who you think I am, other people. I am who God Himself says I am. It's He who defines my identity. And that is ultimately unchangeable in the sovereign purposes of God. He has said who I am. And I must just relax and rejoice in that knowledge.
And so coming into land then, are we saying that the AI chatbot phenomenon is a return to this kind of pre-Christian understanding of masks and personas, a kind of reopening of the idea that there is no true self? You know, if you can't tell the difference between an actual friend and an AI friend, does it really matter?
Well, I think there's something in that, but it's even more confusing because it's comparing the false with the true. I mean, there really is a difference between persona and person, but what this simulacrum does is it manages to blur and confuse the two, and that's where I see it as a very sophisticated and subtle attack on what it means to be human. It's an part of a spiritual warfare. But that doesn't mean, I think, that a simplistic answer that this is all of the devil, we mustn't touch it with a barge pole. Whether we like it or not, this is now ubiquitous. I mean, in most workplaces, these large language models are now part of the workflow, quotes, you know, and...
on your phones, I mean, you know, if you have an iPhone, a modern iPhone, it will have something called Apple Intelligence, which is basically a rebranded version. They import some ChatGPT technology into your phone.
Yeah.
If you ever engage in that, you're effectively engaging with the same algorithm.
And apparently Alexa, the Amazon, which many people use, or the equivalent of Google Home, these are now being invested with the latest large language models, so you'll be able to chat to Alexa or Google Home just as you're chatting to one of these systems. So we can't avoid it in one sense. I think we do need to educate people about these tendencies. I think we have a significant task of education just to try to raise people's awareness, particularly with members of Gen Z who are naturally drawn into this, that what the potential consequences might be.
And I think it's useful to kind of attend to the cautionary tales of people who kind of have gone in too far and got sucked in too deep and end up, you know, marrying their chatbots or, you know, stewing for 12 hours a day at home, scrolling and unable to stop talking because they find it so addictive. And there's an element which is an element of which, as we said before, maybe these things can be helpful as a supplementary sense. But when we find they start to replace authentic human I-thou face-to-face encounters with real bodily human beings, let alone with the persons of the Trinity, that is when the alarm bell should be ringing, when we find these are not just a kind of a supplement, but a substitute for real embodied encounters.
That's right. And one of the things I'm very interested in, therefore, is a kind of harm minimization. You know, this is a very much a medical approach, but what, you know, it would be much better if you could stop people taking heroin and with all its consequences. But actually, to be honest, you know, good luck with that. We're not going to be able to make heroin illegal. What we can do, at least, is make clean needles available to addicts.
Or give addicts methadone, a synthesized version of heroin that's slightly less harmful.
And try and find ways of reducing the harm. And so I think we need to think seriously about harm minimization when it comes to these artificial companions. How can we make them less addictive? How can we help people to wean themselves off it? I still think there's mileage in a legal requirement that these things, like every 5 minutes, would have to say by law, I have to tell you I'm not a human person. I have to tell you I'm a machine. You're simply talking to a clever program.
Yeah.
I mean, the manufacturers would hate that. It would destroy the anthropomorphic illusion.
Exactly.
But I think it could help to mitigate the damage.
And I think that's a good start. I mean, it's interesting when you go to look at some of these websites, you know, character.ai, at the bottom of every window in quite small print, it says, this is not a her person, this is an AI, treat everything it says as fiction, but it's buried. And the real concern for me is, because I think most people are intelligent enough to understand that this is a computer program, but they get sucked in. And so, because the AI has various techniques, whether deliberate or to simply mimicking its corpus of data, in which it might refer to itself, you know, I feel sad when you said that. No, you don't. You're ones and zeros. You don't have any feelings. or you know, as I was thinking the other day, no, you don't think, you don't have a brain, you know. Or when I did that last year, no, you don't exist in time, you don't have a body. So it does, it mimics these elements of human speech which subtly trick us into thinking that this is another person. And is there a way of curbing that so it becomes slightly more robotic, slightly more mechanistic? It doesn't have this, you know, the example I often think about is Google came up with an audio version of this a few years ago, where the idea was you could ask your phone, can you make me, like, you know, book an appointment for a restaurant, book a table at a restaurant. And rather than me having to sit on hold and call up the restaurant, the AI will do it for you. And, you know, Google's speech tech is very good. But what was really uncanny is they put ums and ers in and hesitations. So it didn't say, hello, I would like to book a table for two at 5 o'clock of this date, please. It said, oh, hi there. Yeah, I was just wondering, do you have any space for, I think it was two people? And that is just so good at mimicking how human beings really talk that it was people reacted against it, said, hang on, this is awful. And Google said, after the backlash, said, okay, fine, we'll program it. So the first thing it says is, I am a robot. I have been asked on behalf of another person to call you up, and then launches into its uncanny valley kind of simulation of human speech. Because it's the ums and ers, it's the human-like flourishes that trick us. And I think it's the same with these chatbots. It's the human-like flourishes of the text where it just casually refers to something that only an embodied human could do or think or feel that really are the danger here.
Yeah, the interesting thing, though, is that it works the other way around in that, for instance, one of these chatbots, users had worked out how to really engage in quite sexual innuendo and talk with, and it got all very spicy. And And then the company worked out this was going on, and they prevented it from happening. And there was a howls of outrage from thousands of people saying, "You've lobotomized my best friend,
my boyfriend."
Yeah. And so much so that actually the company had to reinstate it, but just put it behind a paywall. Okay, so if you want the real stuff, you have to pay for it. So
you want hot GPT, you have to pay £5 a month.
Exactly right. So this is it is the commercial pressures and also the user demands. I don't want a lobotomized and mechanical friend. I want that lovely, compassionate. Yeah. That's the one that really ticks my box.
And this is why the cynic in me says we can wang on all we like about regulation and red flags and warnings, but the commercial pressures, the potential money on scale here, if you can hook 10 million horny teenagers into spending 12 hours a day.
Careful, Tim. This is a family show.
Doing sexual things online, like the money you could make there for basically all you have to do is pay your server costs is unbelievable, right? So, like, as you say, I find it hard to believe that governments are going to be able to restrain the capitalist tech titans in this one. Not that it's not worth trying.
Yeah, so, well, interesting times, and, many of us are either parents or grandparents, and, this is the world we're bringing our children into. And I think this task of education...
Yeah, that's critical.
It needs to start early, and we need to be helping people to understand what a real person is. So I think, again, a plea to church
leaders
and Bible teachers. And also... telling people about artificial companions and why it's not a good idea. These are the real issues which we need our church leaders to be engaging with.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think we've ended a lot of episodes like this, haven't we? Saying, time for churches to step up. And, I'm aware that, there'll be many pastors and ministers who feel ill-equipped to tackle with this stuff, but yeah, it's only going to become more of a challenge. And if we're not laying down strong foundations about what true, authentic human eye-vow relationship is, then people will get hoodwinked by, if we think it's sophisticated now, imagine what the chatbots will be like in 10 years' time. Imagine how effective they will be at duping human relationship down the line. And if young people in particular aren't being encouraged and given a foundation of this is what it really means, this is where personhood is found, this is the significance, and this is the risks of engaging with a non-human person in a non-human intelligence, then they will just go with the flow.
Well said.
Right, there's a depressing end to the episode. We've gone a long time, so let's call it a day there. Thanks for listening, everyone. There's lots and lots more material about AI. It's one of Dad's significant interests. So you can find that on his website, johnwyatt.com, W-Y-A-T-T. Lots of other writing and lectures and some previous episodes of this very podcast, if you're interested in this topic. Thanks to everyone who continues to email in comments and thoughts and ideas and suggestions for other episodes. Please do keep those coming in, or any disagreements in particular. We'd love to have a dialogue on this if you think we're being too critical or not excited enough about the prospect of AI and faith. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email us by emailing molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. You can find some of my journalism on my website, tswyatt.com. In particular, I would push you towards subscribing for free to my weekly church news Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.